Hey everyone, this is John, and this is the Nintendo Show, the best damn Nintendo podcast on the internet. This is a filler episode. I am solo, so I want to clear the deck of some topics that I have on tap that we're not going to be able to discuss in a timely fashion when we're all here together, because next up is going to be the Retro Show. We're not going to skip it this month. We've been a little bit delayed with some of the recording schedule because, once again, I've had a stretch of work where I've had to be there at 5 a.m., so still technically nighttime when I've had to be there. So it's been, just been really exhausting when I get home from work and really hard to coordinate a day where I would be up for a recording. So we postponed last week. We got a little bit of a cushion with the After Dark, with the Halloween movies we were talking about. And we're going to all be back together in a couple of days here for the Retro Show. And then, you know, the November recording schedule will probably be a bit loose because of the release of Pokemon, the Diamond Pearl remakes. So we'll probably do some Pokemon discussion at the end of the month as opposed to the beginning. But, you know, we'll get some stuff out there. We'll definitely hit all of the major things that are happening. That's one of the things I'm going to be doing in this episode, is there was some news that's been going on in the world of Nintendo. And then I also want to do some discussions of a couple of new releases that I've been playing that I just want to close the book on. So probably an abbreviated episode here again, as I usually do when I'm solo. And then, you know, we'll have a nice big marathon episode when we do all of the retro stuff. We got some really solid video game discussions to do on the Retro Show this time around, so it won't all just be movies and music. There are some significant video game releases that are going to be really exciting to talk about. But anyway, without further ado, a couple of news tidbits that I wanted to talk about. Advance Wars 1 and 2 remakes were delayed. They were due out at the beginning of December. I believe it was December the 3rd. And they were pushed into spring of next year, which is hugely unfortunate. I was really looking forward to those at the end of the year here. Not a super long delay to push them into spring, maybe 6 months at the most. But, you know, it's really a bummer because that was like kind of like the last thing to fill out the release schedule here. So I mean, it's still a really solid year, and I'm probably still going to be super busy with Shin Megami Tensei 5 and the Pokemon Diamond Pearl remakes at that point. So, you know, it would have been a really full plate with Advance Wars in there as well. But, you know, I would have always made time because Advance Wars is a really cool game. Really, really unfortunate that one had to get pushed. And as far as the December schedule goes, I think that there's still like a Big Brain Academy coming out on that same day on the 3rd. I think like Danganronpa is coming out that month. So, you know, there's still some releases, at least, you know, worth paying attention to, but nothing that's going to be like a super must-buy day one purchases, especially with two really big RPGs coming out in the heart of November that'll still be playing probably into January and February. So, you know, it is what it is, and it's a bummer. So hopefully, you know, we'll be seeing that game sooner rather than later. Maybe, you know, end of March or into April. We'll see. The other big thing that happened this the past couple weeks was they announced the big Animal Crossing update. So they had that direct, I believe it was on the 15th, and they announced a few things, including a free update, a paid update, and then they also got into the Nintendo Online expansion pack pricing structure and sort of release information and all that. It is live at time of recording here, and I might as well address that first. They released, there's N64 games and Sega Genesis games. I'm not going to go through the entire lineup. One, because I didn't have it written down, and two, because you can probably already, you know, jump onto the internet or whatever point and see what games there are. But as far as the lineup goes, I think it's a pretty good initial release. You get a lot of the expected, the standard bearers, especially with the N64. And, you know, again, a really solid, like, lineup of ones that have been announced as, you know, coming to the system relatively soon. And I think the elephant in the room is the pricing structure of this, because the expansion pass model for the Nintendo Online subscription is $49.99, $50 for the added content of the N64 games as well as the Sega Genesis games. And, you know, from 30,000 feet, paying $50 for a year of, you know, the online service, you know, everything that goes along with that, including all of the retro system access, isn't bad. It's not a bad price. I think the worst thing about this is that it's a 150% price increase over what they already had. And I think that they weren't able to put forth enough value proposition to be like, hey, this is going to be worth more than double of what you're already paying. And I think a lot of this is, you know, ripping off the Band-Aid. I think that, you know, when the next generation of system comes around, that there won't be this multi-priced tier system. It's just all going to be that higher priced tier system. But who knows? Maybe they will have a tier thing again. I think it would be a mistake. I think that it was a mistake to put something out priced this high. Really big misstep to try to, you know, more than double the price of this thing. It is a really big ask, especially people who are just up for renewal. And there are some weird little hiccups with it. Like, if you have a family plan, let me start at the beginning here. If you have the online subscription and want to upgrade to the expansion pass, and you're not up for renewal yet, you can get a prorated discount. So, you know, if you are, you know, a certain amount of time into your subscription, you can upgrade it into the expansion pass, but for a lower price, you know, for the remaining months you have left. So you won't be paying the full amount if you're not getting the full year of it, basically. But if you have a family plan and want to change to just a single person expansion pass, you can't get that sort of like price adjustment or prorated discount. You have to go with entire renewal, basically like you're canceling and starting over again for an entire year. So, I mean, they've taken, you know, a bit of a publicity hit, and I think that it's probably why they tagged it onto a big Animal Crossing announcement, because, you know, I think in general it's been a really positive year for them messaging wise. You know, they had a really solid E3. They had a really solid Nintendo Direct not too long ago, like back in September. And this is a really good Animal Crossing Direct, I think. And then kind of put this on the end. Oh yeah, and by the way, we're going to charge you more than double for, you know, these N64 games. And they're also trying to, I think, give a little bit of added value with putting the Animal Crossing DLC into the expansion pass pricing structure. That's a bit of a weird one, though, because it's attached to your subscription. So if you stop subscribing, then you lose access, as far as I understand it. Maybe this isn't correct. But if you stop subscribing to the expansion pass, you lose access to the paid Animal Crossing DLC, which, you know, I think there's been speculation about, you know, will the expansion pass have, you know, DLC included with it going forward. I think that was really optimistic to think that that might happen. I don't think that's really Nintendo's MO to, like, hey, here's additional free content. I think that something that everyone should remember is, like, this is their business. Nintendo is not Microsoft, it's not Sony, where it has all of their hands and tentacles into other things. Like, Microsoft is an enormous company, and Microsoft can afford to give things away in order to gain or maintain a market share that they want to maintain in video games. Nintendo does not have their fingers in other pies. Like, video games is, like, selling video games is how they stay in business. So, you know, they're in a tough position where they're always going to get compared to, you know, their competition, whether they want to acknowledge, like, Sony and Microsoft and the rest as competition. Like, they are existing within the same space. So people can give their money to, you know, people have a finite amount of money and they can only give it out to access a finite amount of games. So, you know, if people are just going for like the most for the lowest price, there are other options out there. And Nintendo is always going to be compared to those other options. But I think it is worth remembering that all they can do to make money is sell video games. So they're not in a position where they can just give some away the way that Sony and Microsoft do. So, I mean, it is a bad pricing structure. I think that at most they should have gone like an extra $10 and then maybe said Animal Crossing DLC is sold separately, as all other DLC has done to this point, as long as Nintendo's been doing DLC. I really think that this is like what they're testing the waters to see what they can charge, what they can get away with charging for an online subscription, you know, in future generations of hardware. And I think that this is kind of what you know, their market research has shown, like, hey, we can probably try this. And if, you know, people don't upgrade right away, or maybe we lose some people, we're going to make that up in cost. And then when the next generation comes around, this can be our floor. And God, who knows? Maybe when their next generation of hardware rolls around, they start at the $50, and then halfway through the life cycle, they're like, oh, and by the way, here's an $80 one, and it kind of keeps increasing from there. I don't like that sort of thing. You know, the only real thing that I'm using the online subscription for is for the retro games, for the access to the retro games. I don't really play games online at all. I don't, you know, I have the cloud save backups, but it's not something I've ever had to use. I've never played Tetris 99, or any like Mario 35, any of the other like free things that they've put on their online subscription. So yeah, it's a tough pill to swallow, and I think that, you know, as time goes on, people will get used to the idea. But I don't know. I think it was definitely a misstep to take such like 150% price jump. I think it's bad form. So will I pay for it? I don't know. Maybe. I'll see how I feel in like January, February, after the holidays, after I don't have to think about like gift buying or anything like that, when I have, you know, the disposable income to throw around. Let's see how I feel about it then. I don't know. We'll see. So, speaking of the Animal Crossing updates, there are two big things to talk about there. One is the paid DLC I just mentioned. I believe it's $29.99 if you're buying it separately, or if you have the expansion pass, you are getting it included with that. And that's like, I forget what they call it, Happy Home Paradise or something like that. It's similar to the Happy Home Designer 3DS game that they did back in the day. Where, you know, you're given like, you go to this island, you basically, you're on your island, and you just tell them like you want to go to work, and they take you to this other island where you spend time like talking to a client and designing their house around their particular tastes. Not really why I got into Animal Crossing. It's probably not something I'm going to indulge in. I might show it to Des, see if she likes it. I doubt it, though. I don't think that's something I'm going to get very much mileage out of. And I'd really only give it a shot if I do end up getting the expansion pass. I'm not going to drop the cash for this particular thing. Not really what I spend any time in Animal Crossing doing. But there's a big free update coming on the 5th, November the 5th. And there's a lot of stuff in this. Some of the stuff I didn't recognize because it's the first Animal Crossing game that I've played, but there is an expansion to the museum called Brewster's Roost. It's a little coffee shop, and you can invite people using amiibo cards, or you can invite your friends through the online play. Other characters, villagers might come in and sit down and have some coffee, like have conversations with them and such. I'm not exactly sure what you do with this thing other than like sit down and watch some text come in. I don't know if like there's some sort of like a Pokedex of coffee that you're supposed to like collect and develop. I don't know. It seems like an Animal Crossing thing to be like, hey, find all these different coffees and collect them so you can have them at your shop. That seems like something they would do. I don't know how this works. I didn't really do any research. I don't know. This is one of the things where people really wanted like a coffee shop. I think this is kind of like a bronze medal because it's just an extra wing added on to the museum. And I think people wanted more standalone structures. I mean, I already kind of built a coffee shop on my island. So you can kind of have to get creative with some of the things you can put out in the open island rather than the inside in order to get a coffee shop looking area. But I don't know. It seems fine. I don't think I'm going to spend much time in it. I might one day get around to collecting like all the coffees if that's something you can do. But I haven't even gotten around to collecting any like all of the bugs and sea creatures and fish yet. I'll get to it someday, but I'm not in any particular rush. Something that does look pretty interesting is Catton. He is this little frog-looking thing. He has a boat on your pier, and he can take you to random islands. And these look like the Nook Miles islands that like randomly generate. You can go there and you know chop down trees and collect resources and get things selling and find new villagers if you got some empty lots on your island that you want to populate. I think the biggest difference here is, one, you're not needing like a Nook Miles ticket, as far as I know, in order to go. You can just go whenever you want. And he could take you to an island that might be a different season or a different time of day, so you can find different things. And I think the different seasons thing is really cool, because if there's something like a fish or a bug that will only come out in the winter, but it's you know summer in your hemisphere, it gives you an opportunity to get those sort of things when they're off season. And I think that's a really cool addition to collecting. There also seems to be like a different type of collectible, like a vine that's growing on the cliffs. They didn't really give many details. I don't know if that's something that's been in a previous Animal Crossing game, but I'm not even sure what you would do with that sort of thing, but it looked like the villagers in the videos they were shown were taking vines off the cliff and adding them into their pockets. So maybe that's a thing. Another thing that I'm probably going to spend some time with is Harve's Island Plaza. I think I went to Harve's Island one time and I wasn't interested in doing like the wedding photo thing, so I just left and never re-engaged with it. But the Island Plaza looks really cool because it's another thing that you can like develop. You can put some money into their shops, and there are like it gives you a reason to use the money that you've amassed. I've amassed a ton of bells and not had really anything to use them for quite some time. But you can like have different shops to open up. I'm really interested in like the art grifter guy, the guy with the steamboat that shows up on your island randomly and has mostly fake stuff. It looked like he had a shop on the island, because I'd really like to finish out the museum, because I'm probably 70% of the way there, and I'd really just like to finish the real stuff in there and not have to deal with, you know, browsing through looking to see if anything's fake, which they mostly are. So really excited to see what all happens with that plaza and what sort of stuff you're able to get in there. There's going to be more hairstyles, more house exterior options, more storage. You can do ceiling decor, accent walls. So a lot of different stuff you'll be able to do with your houses and character design. You can participate in like group activities, like group stretches, which is kind of funny. You can like do like motion control, so you can like do like actual stretches in real life as your Animal Crossing characters do them together, which is kind of fun. There are hourly ordinances, so if there are people who like wake up later than you want them to, or like go to sleep earlier than you want them to, you can set your island clock more to align with your own personal schedule with when you play, so you can say hi to everybody. There's more camera options for taking screenshots, more KK Slider songs. You can get to music boxes, so there's a different way to listen to all of the KK Slider songs. More bridges and inclines. You can place ladders, which is really cool, because there are places where I usually use a ladder just for quicker access than my inclines around the island. So I'd just really like to place some ladders so I don't ever have to take mine out again. More different types of fences. more customization options, more things you can use your Nook miles for, which is great because I have a ton of those as well. There's a Ferris wheel. I'm really excited to get the Ferris wheel and kind of fill out my carnival area. That's going to be really cool. There's more stuff at Nook's Cranny, more stuff to buy. There's vegetables to grow, which I'm already starting to scout out locations on my island where I can change things around and get some vegetable gardens going. That looks really cool. You can use those things to cook different things and use that as like more decor. You can set it on tables and stuff. Oh, there's an ABD terminal outside the store so you can get some more cash really quick. You know, I always wondered, you know, why they just don't give you like a debit card. Like, why not just be able to access your money from everywhere? You got to kind of, if you want something really expensive, you got to like run to get some money, which, you know, this terminal outside the store makes a little bit easier. But why not just like give you a pocket item where it's just a debit card and you can just swipe it at the store and just buy up anything you want? I probably would buy more stuff at the store if I could just access my money anywhere. But anyway, there's more locomotion options, specifically like if there's some narrow spaces, you can now kind of creep through them rather than getting stuck, which is, I think, going to be handy if people like to really design the inside of their houses and have a lot of stuff to make it look really nice. That's really cool. There's also like collectible things, gyroids, that like you dig them up and then you gotta like water them when they grow into things, and you can use them as like decorations and make noises and shit. I think that might be something from previous Animal Crossing games. I'm not sure what that's all about, but you know, some people seem to be excited that those are coming back. But yeah, there's a ton of free stuff going on with this 2.0 update. It's going to be the last free update, which, you know, they did specifically mention free, which means that there might be more DLC at some point, paid DLC. I don't know. I kind of think that this was a big content dump, and now they have their big paid one. Maybe they'll do another big paid one that's like another, I don't know, like a Mario Party Animal Crossing board game. Like, what was that one? Amiibo Festival or some shit like that. But I don't know. I don't think that this is the kind of game where they would do paid updates or like for something like here's more furniture or, you know, here's a different type of fruit you can grow on your island. I don't think that's what they want to use the paid DLC for in this particular game. Maybe they would. I could stand corrected on that one. We'll see. We'll see what ends up happening. But for now, like, I think that this was content that was a long time coming, and they got really set back by COVID and working from home and all that. So at some point, maybe they just decided, let's just hold it all back and do it all at once. Because there's a lot going on here, and a lot of it seems really cool. So I'm going to be into it. I haven't stopped playing Animal Crossing. I still check in every day and do some little chores around the island. It's going to be fun to actually, you know, start doing some designing again and figuring out, you know, where I'm going to put things in order to, you know, get all the stuff on there that I want. But yeah, I think the last little bit of news that I want to talk about is there's going to be a DLC for, there's a DLC announcement for a game that's not out yet, and it's Shin Megami Tensei V. And Atlus does tend to do paid DLC. It's not surprising, but it's another one of those situations. Like, I think one of the Fire Emblems, maybe it was Fire Emblem Awakening, that or one of the other 3DS Fire Emblems that had like day one DLC, and that just always leaves a bad taste in my mouth because it's clearly content that is finished. Like, this stuff is done. Otherwise, it wouldn't be DLC, or otherwise it wouldn't be day one. So it's kind of like, here's a new game and here's stuff that we held back that now you have to pay extra for. And if you do indulge in all the DLC, you end up paying close to $90 for this new game. So there's like 50% of the price of the game. The DLC is 50% of the price of the main game, which, you know, it's a lot to ask. And a lot of times Atlus does bank on, you know, their most hardcore fans, you know, paying the extra price, like going for the top tier model. So, you know, that's how they monetize their somewhat niche products. And I don't like it. I don't like having this DLC. Like, if it's, I think they only like go through the facade of like it's finished, but we're not going to announce it until like a month later. And I think for the main reason is that some of it is like supposed to be this way to ease up the difficulty of the game. Like, there is a easier mode called safety mode, and I think that one's actually a free, actually no, that might even be a paid DLC. But there, when you start the game, there's like the casual mode as well as normal and hard, and safety mode is pretty much story mode. Like, you're just kind of playing through the game to see like the narrative and the character interactions, and it's not going to give you any pushback at all. But they do some other things in these DLC packs, specifically with your Metamas, where you have like ones you can, that will earn you extra money and extra experience to kind of push you forward, like give you that extra boost for it. Fire Emblem Awakening did a similar thing where you could fight these quick battles that would get you a lot of cash, or some other quick battles that would get you a lot of experience. And it was a way of grinding out characters if you want to do a lot of min-maxing. That sort of stuff, like, I don't really have a huge issue with. Being day one DLC, it is kind of shitty to like be like, hey, here's some stuff that will help like keep you progressing forward if you're new to the series, but you got to pay for it. I don't like that. And then the other like big content pieces that have been separated out and sold separately are, there's a True Demon DLC pack, and that is a reference back to Shin Megami Tensei 3 Nocturne, which I played for the first time earlier this year on Switch. And it's the True Demon stuff in that game was, there were boss fights that you would have to go through in order to unlock the sort of optimal or canonical ending to the game. And I think it was like 6 or 7 boss fights. So, you know, getting this DLC in Shin Megami Tensei 5 gets you those boss fights, but then allows you to fight the Demi-Fiend, the main character from Shin Megami Tensei Nocturne. Not recruitable, as far as I understand, but it does get you that fight, which, you know, it seems like such easy side content to have in the game. It should be a side quest and included in the main price. This is content that's clearly carved out and then added back in for a price. And the other thing, there are a couple other things, recruitable characters, Cleopatra, and there are two other ones who are escaping my mind. But basically, you have these DLC, and these are like $3, $4, $5 that get you these quests where you fight these characters and then are able to recruit them or fuse them into your party. And again, this is the sort of thing where if they did this a couple months down the road, it's like, hey, here's some new characters that you can have. But you fight them in a boss fight, and then you can recruit them, and then you can fuse them. But to have them on the first day, these were done, these were finished, and they're asking people to pay extra just to get access to the thing that's already done for a game that you're paying $60 for. Like, it's not cool. It's been a tough month for DLC announcements. This is like a shitty 1-2 punch of poor pricing structures from both Nintendo and Atlas. But anyway, let's talk about something happy for a few minutes, because I finished off Metroid Dread a few days ago. I got the 100%. I did all the Shine Spark puzzles and got all my tanks and all my missile upgrades and all that. Metroid Dread is really fucking good. What a great game. There are some difficult moments, but I think that, you know, none of the boss fights take more than 3 or 4 tries if you're doing things like the game wants you to do, and like poking around, backtracking, finding, you know, your power-ups that's going to optimize you for the next fight coming up. And I did spend a lot of time. I think like my final play clock when I got to the end was just shy of 14 hours. And a lot of that is padded because I wanted to paint the map. The map does this thing, like I was talking about on a different show, where not only does it give you like the shape of the room, but it also like paints the map of where you've been in that room. So I would go around and try to make sure that every corner was filled in, so there wasn't any part of the map that looked like, you know, I hadn't been there before. So that probably added a couple hours onto the play clock, because the room that would take me 2 seconds to run through then took me 20 seconds to make sure that I, you know, marked everything. But like understanding the map is key to progressing in this game. It is a really valuable resource, and it makes me miss dual screen gaming, because having a map always accessible on a bottom screen is really useful information, especially when you have to rely on it so much in this game. Understanding, you know, what things on the map mean and where there might be gaps in the map really are key to progressing, because when you get a new power up, there's usually a couple of things you can do immediately with it, but there's almost always like points in the game, like in a given area, where you have like a progression halt and you have to stop and think, okay, I can't get forward anymore. Where can I go back to that might where I might be able to progress or collect something that I need? And the game is like, the level layout is so smart in this game. It's so good how when you do that backtracking and you find something and it ends up, you know, taking you to a different area and looping you around and getting you the next power up that you need in order to progress, you know, in the area you were before. And the map changes. There are actions that you will take, things that will happen throughout the narrative of the game that will change the way the map is laid out in previous areas. So when you're going back through, things look different and you have to interact with things differently. It is always interesting moving throughout the game. And things that you do, like sometimes you'll drop a platform down and then be like going through the area again, thinking you can get up one way. Like, oh, wait, no, I changed this. I can't get back up that way anymore. There's always something that, you know, when you're backtracking through an area, that something has changed. And, you know, when you're doing like your final sweep through, when you have all your power-ups, it feels really good to like see the obstacles in your way and know like, oh, I can get through this now, or, you know, I know the way around it now. I can't say enough about how much I like how Mercury Steam and Nintendo built these levels. I think it's a really, really smartly laid out world. But yeah, like there's a ton of really cool boss fights, like I mentioned before. Three or four tries for really, really tough ones, and you'll get the hang of it. I think there was one boss, I think I mentioned it when we were talking about this game before, that gave me problems. It took me maybe six or seven tries as opposed to three or four. But it was when you had to fight two little Chozo warrior guys at the same time, and it took me a while to like figure out where I wanted to like go and lure them to where I could get some damage off onto one of them before the other one tried to ambush me from behind, so I had time to escape. But, you know, figuring out, you know, enemy attacks and how they broadcast them, and which ones you can counter and which ones you can't, and when you should try to counter and when you should just dash away, like the bosses are all really smartly built, because, you know, they're always going to, you know, rotate the same like three or four different attacks, and once you figure out which ones you're going to avoid and which ones you're going to counter, you know, it feels really good to just master it and, you know, get through a boss fight taking very little damage, as opposed to when you're getting like your butt kicked two tries before. I think it's really, really good the way all of those are built. None of the power-ups are specifically surprising. You're pretty much gaining things in order that's very familiar. You're not getting anything that's too surprising. There might be one or two things that are new in this game. Like there's like an intermediate bomb in between like a power bomb and like your super bomb. And you know, it's pretty standard in a lot of Metroid games. Like once you get something like the space jump and the screw attack, some things just become irrelevant. because you become so powerful, like a lot of things are just dying when you're making contact with them. And something that ends up happening in a lot of Metroid games, and Metroid Dread is no exception, is once you get the space jump and the screw attack, your grapple beam becomes insignificant. They do try to keep it relevant with there are certain doors that you have to use your grapple beam in order to open them up. I think Metroid Prime 3 Corruption was probably the most successful in keeping the grapple beam relevant, because there were certain enemies that, you know, you would want to use your grapple beam on before you engage them, just like blasting them away with your gun or your missiles. There are some other things, like the invisibility thing. They have a couple of places early on where, you know, outside of your Emmy encounters, you're going to want to use your invisibility, but it's not really something that's going to be significantly used in your regular traversal outside of Emmy areas, in the second two-thirds of the game. It's only really going to be important for exploration in the first third of the game. Which, you know, there's a ton of power-ups in this game. I can understand why, you know, some of them aren't going to be useful to the very end. But it all, you know, it also makes you wonder, like, why bother having this in there? Like, why have this power-up if it's not going to be useful until the end? And it's got to be a difficult thing to balance, because they probably really did want that cloaking for the Emmy encounters, and it would be weird if it was only available in enemy encounters. So, you know, from a design perspective, it's got to be really difficult to balance that sort of thing. I mean, especially once you're getting toward the end, because you're moving very quickly. And one of the major things for exploration that this invisibility is used for is for certain doorways. There are doorways that have like motion sensors in front of them. So if you try to just run in there, it's going to sense you and the door will shut. Whereas if you're invisible, it won't sense you. It'll stay open. But it also slows you down. And turning invisible and slowing down toward the end of the game probably doesn't feel very good. So unfortunate that, you know, that sort of thing they don't find a use for later. I understand why, though. I also really kind of liked the Shine Spark challenges. They're like these really specific challenges throughout the game. If you play the game, you're aware of what they are, because they're requiring you to use your speed dash and then like bank it so that you can get a super powerful jump in order to break through certain barriers. But there's like a lot of really specific, like you have to be super precise with the where you're using it and where you're like rebanking your speed charge in order to get the power up. And sometimes like the reward is just like a small missile expansion. Sometimes it's a larger missile expansion. But there are a lot of them that would be really frustrating if you're trying to figure them out on your own. Maybe there's seven or eight throughout the game. I definitely look up solution to at least four of them. And they're the sort of challenge where I don't think there's any shame in looking up the solution to any of them if you need a hint, because sometimes just finding the space where you have to like get your running start is challenging, because you have to run a certain amount of distance before you can even charge up the super jump thing. So even like if you've seen the solution, you still have to pull off some really specific maneuvers and have really good timing with it. So I don't think that there's anything wrong with looking up a solution if you need to, a hint about it. And sometimes there's multiple solutions. There's like a couple different places where you can charge up the run. But, you know, for most of them, it's going to be like a really specific, you need to do it this way. But yeah, Metroid Dread, a really fucking good game. I am super impressed with the job that Mercury Steam did with this one. I hope they get another shot at a Metroid game, even though this one kind of closes the book on the story arc of Metroid as it has been to this point. You know, I hope they get another shot to do another game, whether, you know, they start up a new story arc, or, you know, they do like a story in the middle somewhere, like the Metroid Prime games or Metroid Other M. Really, really cool to see the studio work with Nintendo in this way and come up with such a great product. Oh, and the other thing I need to address. Like, apparently, like there's Switch emulators and ways to steal this game and play it like on a PC and stuff. And there are some, you know, what used to be reputable video game sites who were promoting playing this game in 4K by use of an emulator. And of course the wink there is always, you know, download the ROM. You know, the ethics of emulators, I think, is, you know, not particularly in question. Like, using an emulator to play a game that you own is perfectly ethical. Using an emulator to steal a game, especially when it's something so new like Metroid Dread, I think it is without question very unethical. There were people who worked to make this game, and there are people who, you know, work in the factories to make the cases and the artwork and the actual cartridges. There are people who are affected when, you know, these sort of games are stolen. And I would venture a guess that the Venn diagram of people who are using emulators and the people who are using emulators to play games they already own is very little overlap. Like, the ethics of emulators is always like, oh, well, you can use it to play games that you already own. Yeah, I don't think very many people are doing that. These games, like the ROMs, are being shared and stolen, and emulators being used to play them. So, you know, the ethics get a little blurrier, I think, when the games are older. Like, if someone were to use an emulator to play a version of Metroid Other M that they did not own, I don't really see too much of an issue with that. I don't think there's going to be a way that you could give Nintendo or, you know, Team Ninja or anybody involved in making that game any sort of money for that game. So as far as, you know, emulating that, and downloading a ROM, I don't think that's such a big deal. But Metroid Dread came out like fucking yesterday. You know, don't be a piece of shit. Don't download ROMs and use emulators to play them. And the last game that I wanted to talk about is a game that I've been playing called Astria Ascending. It's a little RPG that came out at the end of September, I think. But I've been tinkering with it, playing for, you know, about an hour a day. A lot of times it feels like homework. It is a turn-taking, pretty traditional JRPG. There is a character class system. There's a job system where, you know, you can every character is kind of like locked into a job, and then you can like expand their job and their job tree, and so they can acquire different skills and stats from other classes. And that's okay. I think that's implemented pretty well. That's fun enough. I think something that hasn't quite happened yet is, like, I don't know, the game is, from what I'm reading, like 40 or 50 hours long if you're doing all the side content. And I am 22 hours in, so I've played a significant amount, and I'm maybe like halfway through the first like sphere grid of the first job that I got, and like maybe a little like 10% into a second one. So I haven't really made too much progress in mixing and matching any of the job skills. And a lot of times, like, I'm going through the game and my party construction is a pretty boilerplate JRPG, where I have, you know, the healer, the black mage, the tank, and maybe a striker. But the game is built a lot around using elemental affinities and weaknesses in order to buff up your next attack. So how it works is, every encounter that you get into in the game, every enemy is going to have a weakness. And if you hit that weakness, it gives you like a little token, a little glowy stone in your bank. And what you do is you can burn those in order to buff up your next action. So if you have one, you can use it, and it will give a 50% increase to your next attack or spell or skill. And you can burn as many as four at one time. And what you do is, if you bank four and use them all at once, you are quadrupling the power of your next attack. So exploiting weaknesses gets you more of those. It gets you through the battles quicker. It's especially effective when you're dealing with things like bosses. But in order to clear the fights quickly, 9 times out of 10, it's you're relying on your Black Mage character, who's got the access to the most types of elemental spells. You have fire, ice, earth and wind, lightning and water, and there's also light and dark. Black Mage doesn't have access to light and dark unless you get creative with some of like the sub jobs that you can give it. But just having like 6 out of the 8 available alignments on one character, you know, it makes it to where you're just trying to keep that character alive so they can bank as many of the gem tokens as they can. So you're waiting for their next turn, using them all, and then trying to do as much damage again. And almost every battle plays out that way. And there are some other character classes like a fencer, and there's an assassin and a thief and a dark knight, and these things all seem really cool, but it's just not an inefficient way of clearing a fight. I mean, especially the thief character. I was super excited to use the thief character. I love thief characters. But every time I would go to just like perform an action like a steal, it would always miss. So he sits in the back of my party, and of the 8 playable characters, 4 are in a fight, but everyone gains experience equally. So, you know, I'm still upgrading the character and trying to unlock more things to make him more useful. But even at this point, where he's got the mug ability, which will do damage and steal, he's just like stealing consumable items. I'm not really getting anything like any like new amazing gear out of it. So there are characters that like the summoner, who have just kind of been exiled outside of the party, and I never use the things. The story is very narrative focused. I've totally lost track of where the narrative is when they start talking. I just kind of set the controller down and look at my phone for a couple of minutes until they're done. A lot of times, like, I've gotten to the point in this game where I'm okay with them talking, because if I set a goal, like, okay, I'm just going to try to get an hour, like, play an hour of this game today and get through it. If they start talking, like, cool, I know that I got like 3 minutes where I can do something else and I don't have to pay attention to this anymore. And, you know, a lot of that is because of the battle system, which it has some good ideas, but it's just overall uninspired because I'm doing the same things over and over again. And some of that is because of the dungeon layouts. They have like these dungeons, it's all 2D side scrolling. And there's a little bit of platforming, but then there's always like these really super simple, super light puzzle, like intro dungeons to Legend of Zelda caliber stuff that's really uninteresting. The map system for the dungeons is also, you know, confusing and uninspired, unintuitive, like how you're reading the maps and how you're like flipping through like the different levels or layers of the map. It's just not easy to read, and like scrolling around on the map is super slow. You can zoom in and out, but then sometimes you end up losing the thread of what area is going to lead to where, because if there's a door on the map, it'll have like this little blue string that leads, like shows you where it goes into another part of the map. I'm doing a lot of complaining about the maps because I really like them in games. But this one's just not—it's not good. And like the game overall, like it's fine. I think there's like some stuff that they had that were pretty good ideas, but it just lacks like the inspired like enemy and boss design to bring it all together, to make things interesting, to make it interesting to use these different classes of characters and really optimize how you're building these jobs in order to get the most out of your characters. It's a shame, because like we talk about in a lot of RPGs, the game is sort of tuned so that, you know, they want it to be like you can use whichever party you want. You can play to your style rather than you having to learn how to play on the game's terms. And because they're casting so wide a net, it ends up being like your character that can do the most, the Black Mage, is just going to be the character you get the most utility out of. And it prevents you from experimenting with anybody else. But yeah, I mean, the game is trading a lot on its visual style. It does have like a really detailed hand-drawn sort of look to it. It does, like, the character movements are, you know, it reminds me of a mobile game. It's not like stiff, but there's not a whole lot of movement to the characters. It's like their legs move, but they're not like almost like paper dolls, how you like you're seeing their limbs moving, but it doesn't look like, you know, their entire character is like moving together in one motion. Like things are moving independent of each other. But anyway, like the character designs are fun. They're it's kind of like the antithesis of Final Fantasy XII, where, you know, you have like these interesting different types of people populating the world, but you play as five white people. You actually do get a bunch of different types of people that, you know, like there's bird people and lizard people and fish people who like walk around in these reverse scuba suits. So you get a lot of different character species types, which is kind of fun. But yeah, like overall, I'm getting through it, but I'm going to try to finish it. I'm going to try to, you know, meet the game on its own terms and see if anything inspiring happens. I think I'm getting close to the halfway mark. I don't know. We'll see. We'll see how this game ends up striking me as I get toward the end, see if I get a more developed opinion of it. But I don't know. I'm not super optimistic. And on that downer of a note, that's going to be the end of this filler show. Like I mentioned, we're going to talk about some retro games coming up next. And then, you know, November is also going to get a little bit wonky, like I was saying before. Because I don't know that we're going to do episodes every week because of the Thanksgiving holiday in the U.S. I might end up doing another like filler show, or, you know, maybe we'll do an After Dark or an extended episode that we'll split up into two. We'll see. But I'm glad that I was able to get all these things off the table. And when we start up shows after the retro show, we'll have whole new topics to get into. But that's it. That's the end. Till next time.